Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Chained to the Desk in a Hybrid World, A Guide to Work-Life Balance by Brian E. Robinson, Ph.D. Narrated by Christopher P. Brown. Publisher's note. In this audio edition, you will hear references to figures present in the print and ebook formats of the book. One of the marvels of the world is the sight of a soul sitting in prison with the key in its hand. Rumi. Introduction. Monsters are real, and ghosts are real too. They live inside us, and sometimes they win. Stephen King. My story. As a hard-driving university professor, the thought of a vacation or weekend without work was terrifying, and I structured my life accordingly, just as I did as a boy. One Friday, before a long weekend, I left my office with butterflies in my stomach at the thought of facing an unplanned weekend. I grabbed a memo announcing grant proposal deadlines. Suddenly, calm descended over me, and the adrenaline began to flow as I folded the 3-inch-thick computer printout under my arm. Like an alcoholic with a bottle, I was assured of plenty to drink, calmed by the guarantee of having more to do. That guarantee was an anesthetic, a tranquilizer. But after the proposal was written, the feelings of emptiness, unrest, and depression returned. There were times I needed my work so badly that I hid it from others, the way my alcoholic father needed and hid his bourbon. And just as I once tried to control my father's drinking by pouring out his booze and refilling the bottle with vinegar, the people who loved me sulked, pleaded, and tore their hair out, trying to keep me from working all the time. Every summer, for instance, just before we left on vacation, Jamie, my spouse, would search my bags and confiscate any work I planned to smuggle into our rented beach house on the South Carolina shore. But however thoroughly he searched, he would always miss the tightly folded papers covered with work notes that I had bootlegged into the pockets of my jeans. Later, when Jamie and our close friends invited me to stroll on the beach, I'd say I was tired and wanted to nap. While they were off swimming and playing in the surf, which I considered a big waste of time, I secretly worked in the empty house, bent over a lap desk fashioned from a board. At the sound of their returning footsteps, I'd stuff my papers back into my jeans, hide the board, and stretch out on the bed, pretending to be asleep. I saw nothing strange about my behavior. It's only in hindsight that I say that I was a workaholic. By this, I mean something quite different from saying that I worked hard. I mean that I used to work to defend myself against unwelcome emotional states, to modulate anxiety, sadness, and frustration, the way a pothead uses dope and an alcoholic uses booze. During my tenured professorship at the University of North Carolina at Charlotte, I carried a full teaching load and volunteered for committee assignments while also writing books, conducting research, and establishing a full clinical practice. Ignoring Jamie's frequent pleas that we just do something together, I worked in my windowless office in our basement through evenings, weekends, Thanksgivings, and Christmases. I even worked through most of the day of my father's funeral. While my mothers and sisters broke bread with old neighbors, I toiled in my university office 25 miles away, working on a project so insignificant, I no longer remember what it was. When I stopped thinking of myself as an extraordinarily talented and dedicated professional with a great deal to offer the world, and realized how empty my life had become, I hit bottom. Until then, I'd been proud of my work addiction and well rewarded for it. Jamie might complain that I was never home, and that when I was, I didn't listen. But my university colleagues called me responsible and conscientious. Jamie might call me controlling, inflexible, and incapable of living in the moment. But the promotions, accolades, and fat paychecks that came my way built an ever stronger case against his accusations, and I used them to further vilify him. Why couldn't he pull his own weight? Why couldn't he be more supportive? Why didn't he appreciate my hard work and the creature comforts it provided? Why was he constantly bothering me with problems that distracted me from earning a decent living? After nearly 14 years together, Jamie, who had been trying without success to talk to me about my absence from our relationship and his growing problems with alcohol, told me that he had found someone who would listen to him, and he moved out. My first book had been published, and I had two more books and several funded research projects in the works. I was also recovering from surgery for stress-related gastrointestinal problems. My life was crumbling under my feet, and there was nothing I could do about it. I lost weight, I couldn't eat, I didn't care if I lived or died. I was a chain-smoking, caffeine-drinking work junkie, dogged by self-doubt. I had no close friends, I didn't smile. I thought my colleagues didn't really appreciate my hard work and were breathing down my neck. My memory got so bad that members of my family wondered if I was developing an early-onset Alzheimer's. I snapped at colleagues, and they snapped back. I once angrily confronted a university librarian, demanding the name of the irresponsible faculty member who had kept, for 3 months, a book I needed for research. With a raised brow, she gave me the name. My own. Work had been the one thing that I had always done well, and now even that was turning against me. Yet I couldn't stop working. In the summer of that year, Jamie and I reconciled, and in the fall he checked himself into a treatment center for alcoholism. When I eagerly took part in the family treatment component to help Jamie with his problem, a facilitator confronted me with my own work addiction. I joined Workaholics Anonymous, entered therapy, and began my climb out of the work pit into a saner life. And Jamie and I started to understand the crack in the foundation of our relationship. Today, we celebrate decades together with peace of mind. Some things never change. This book builds on the three editions of My Chained to the Desk. The first edition appeared in 1998, the second in 2007, and the third in 2014. During this 24-year span, many societal changes and research advances have yielded fodder for a new work. In 2019, the World Health Organization, WHO, officially classified work burnout, stemming from chronic workplace stress, as a medical diagnosis, and included the condition in the International Classification of Diseases, the handbook that guides medical providers in diagnosing diseases. Burnout appears in the handbook's section on problems associated with employment or unemployment. It describes burnout as a syndrome conceptualized as resulting from chronic workplace stress that has not been successfully managed. Shortly after the WHO's declaration, a firestorm erupted when Dr. Richard A. Freeman, professor of clinical psychiatry at Weill Cornell Medical College, published an op-ed in the New York Times asking, "Is burnout real?" His supposition was that burnout is everywhere and that nearly everyone seems to have suffered from it. Dr. Freeman argued that when a disorder is reportedly so widespread, it makes me wonder whether we are at risk of medicalizing everyday distress. If everyone suffers from burnout, then no one does, and the concept loses all credibility. Arianna Huffington, founder and CEO of Thrive Global, challenged Friedman's logic. So, it's strange to say, in the face of overwhelming evidence, that a phenomenon can't be real because it's widespread. That's precisely what an epidemic is. Friedman's observation that almost everyone suffers from burnout doesn't refute the existence of a crisis. It makes the case for one. Friedman's comments were emblematic of the mental health profession's rampant denial of certain forms of mental issues related to work stress. If there's no such thing as burnout, then there's no such thing as work addiction. And clinicians have a history of relegating burnout and workaholism to the pop psychology bookshelves. Having experienced the personal damage of work addiction, Hearing people joke about it is painful and cringeworthy. I have spent the greater part of my career exposing the damage overworking causes individuals, families, and businesses. I've treated hundreds, maybe thousands, suffering over broken homes, job losses, and even death because of this invisible illness. To say that the public and media, even the mental health profession, do not take workaholism seriously is an understatement. When it's not praised, workaholism is dismissed as a joke. One lighthearted portrayal in a newspaper cartoon showed a huge empty meeting room with a sign posted at the front that reads, "Workaholics Anonymous." The cartoon's caption says, "Everybody had to work overtime." Advertisers bathe workaholism in the same glamorous light that they poured over cigarettes and liquor in the ads of the 1930s. A Lexus ad in the Wall Street Journal boasted, "Workaholic? Oh, you flatter us." The relentless pursuit of perfection. A radio commercial for a truck praised the versatility of the workaholic 4x4. If you tell people you're a workaholic, they usually chuckle. A 1980 book on workaholics applauded the workaholic lifestyle, presenting it as a virtue, suggesting that workaholics are happy because they are doing what they love. Supporters of work addiction reform have been the targets of ridicule and butts of jokes, as a 1994 commentary from Fortune magazine illustrated. Along with heroin, gambling, sex, and sniffing model airplane glue, work is now taken seriously as something people often get addicted to, in which case they need to get cured. The references to work addiction are instantly psychiatric. The phrase is enveloped in psychobabble about inner insecurities, lives destroyed, and, could it be otherwise, support groups needed. To add insult to injury, a movement is afoot in this country today to deconstruct the term work-life balance. Corporate honcho Jeff Bezos, for example, has advised his Amazon employees to stop aiming for work-life balance because it implies a trade-off between the two. Bezos thereby threatens to erase the work-life boundaries self-professed workaholics have fought so hard to establish. Psst. Denial is not a river in Egypt. Perhaps most alarming of all is the rampant denial among mental health practitioners, as Friedman's op-ed illuminated. In 2012, a professor in the Netherlands who coined the term engaged workaholics argued that, if you love what you do, where's the harm in doing too much? I wonder if that's something anyone would tell an alcoholic, shopaholic, drug addict, overeater, or compulsive gambler. These kinds of comments by fellow professionals reflect ignorance about a condition that wreaks misery and havoc on millions of workers in this country. Obviously, a lot of education is still needed, even for mental health professionals. Which brings me to an even more disturbing situation. Although workaholism has become a household word, sadly, it has not been accepted into the official psychiatric and psychological nomenclature. The American Psychiatric Association considers it a symptom of obsessive-compulsive personality disorder. Jeffrey Kahn, a consultant for the association's Committee on Psychiatry in the Workplace, insists that other professionals who think workaholism is an addiction or a diagnosis in and of itself are missing the boat. It's also shocking that in 2006, a representative of The Priory, Great Britain's high-profile clinic for addiction, charged that workaholism is just something journalists like to write about. In the fifth edition of the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, DSM-5, the American Psychiatric Association recommended that the addictive diagnostic category include both substance use disorders and non-substance addiction, such as gambling. The APA's recognition of behavioral addictions as true addictions is a groundbreaking departure from past actions. But, unfortunately, workaholism or work addiction or overworking were not included as a non-substance addiction in the DSM-5. This oversight occurred even though the association is recommending further study of internet use disorder as an addiction, and is recognizing other addictive disorders that are related to the use of caffeine, inhalants, and tobacco. It comes as no surprise that many in the mental health field continue to assert that job burnout and work addiction are not real. The medical world has a pervasive history of denying the existence of procedures and diagnoses if they're not first identified within its own purview. In the 1970s, we saw this trend with the medical field's initial resistance to consumer demands for prepared childbirth, now accepted and encouraged by physicians because it eases childbirth, a benefit for parents and doctors. Many clinicians and business leaders, vast numbers of whom are workaholics themselves, still do not recognize workaholism, job burnout, or 18-hour pressure cooker days as a mental health problem. Clinicians often overlook workaholism as a contributing issue in troubled relationships when couples seek psychotherapy. Although workaholism surrounds us daily, many in the professional community still consider it much as caffeine or prescription drug use, as harmless, even beneficial. Clinicians often prescribe work immersion as a solution to a problem instead of the cause. Over the years, I've been appalled at the inability of the professional community to recognize, understand, and treat workaholics. Indeed, I have been shocked and dismayed at the pervasiveness of workaholism among practitioners themselves and their attendant denial about their own out-of-control work habits. I have also seen misdiagnosis after misdiagnosis because of this lack of awareness among clinicians. Russell is a case in point. He had a 6-week sabbatical from his job in Silicon Valley and decided to see a clinician for his workaholism. After 6 sessions, he stopped going because the therapist told him there was nothing wrong with him, that it was normal for people to work excessive hours in Silicon Valley. Back at work after his sabbatical, Russell said he felt lost again. He had returned to his old habits of overworking, thinking about work all the time, and reaching for the next recognition like a drug addict searching for the next fix. Deirdre also struggled with the therapeutic community's blindness about work addiction. It's bad enough when family and friends don't get it, but it's truly horrifying when the therapist you hire doesn't get it. 9 different clinicians assured me they could help my husband and me, and each failed to notice the monster that eventually crushed our 24-year marriage. The therapist even told me that words like addiction were not helpful to the therapy. But as far as I'm concerned, to not name the monster is to keep it hidden and its power intact. I wish professionals had a full vocabulary and clear understanding to effectively help families struggling with this unidentified monster. 37-year-old Blake agreed to individual counseling for his work addiction. When Marilyn, his wife, was invited for a session, the therapist dispelled all notions of workaholism and told her to stop being Dr. Marilyn and stop reading pop psychology. After only 2 visits, the therapist told Blake that he was not marriage material due to his childhood. Emma from New Jersey called me in anguish to say that after her husband's successful recovery from alcoholism, he was doing a replay, only this time with workaholism. "It's deja vu," Emma said. "Same story, different drug. But now it's work addiction that takes up 90% of his time. He eats, thinks, and breathes work. My marriage is going down the tubes again, and the therapists are saying, so what? He likes his job." In the 2010s, work addiction was rebranded as the hustle culture for millennials and Gen Zers working relentlessly and continuously by taking on side hustles and freelance gigs as a way of life. The harder and longer you work, the cooler you are. Corporate climbers wear the workaholic badge with pride, proclaiming their loyalty on behalf of the company, proudly announcing that they benched for 18 hours or 3 days on a project. But rarely do you hear adults boast about being on a 3-day drunk or proclaim that they binged on an entire apple pie. Despite this pervasive, massive denial, this book brings good news. Burnout, work stress, and work addiction are being recognized and addressed in the United States and around the world, especially after epidemic rates of job stress and burnout during the pandemic. Workaholics Anonymous has over 1,000 members and holds meetings around the world, in Paris, Sydney, London, Reykjavik, and Bangkok. Historically, social scientists and addiction specialists have generated hundreds of studies on alcoholism, substance abuse, compulsive gambling, and eating disorders, but only a handful on workaholism, a profound omission. In the last few years, however, more social scientists have begun to take work addiction seriously, resulting in published research across the globe, which I incorporate throughout this book. On average, I receive several queries a month from researchers and graduate students studying the problem in such countries as Hungary, Poland, Spain, Slovenia, Turkey, Japan, Canada, Australia, the Netherlands, and the United Kingdom. Pandemic working. Fast, furious, and frenzied. Early in the year 2020, when COVID-19 hit, the landscape of workplaces changed around the world forever. People were forced to work from home, and remote and hybrid working became the new normal. Due to pandemic restrictions, remote workers spent a disproportionate amount of screen time on Zoom to work and connect with families, friends, and colleagues. And studies in 2020 showed that Zoom burnout was a real mental health condition. In 2021 and 2022, the Delta and Omicron variants of the coronavirus led American workers to leave their jobs in droves, creating a context in which people were prompted to take stock of their priorities and triggering what has been called the Great Resignation. This mass exodus had employees reassessing what mattered most in their careers after a year and a half working from home, whether that is a more diverse workplace, opportunities for advancement, or an overall healthy workplace culture. The term pandemic posture was coined to refer to the bad posture that people developed from remote working and being slouched over computers in makeshift home offices for extended periods during the quarantine. And people referred to the extra pounds that they gained from stress eating and lack of exercise as the Quarantine 15. In 2021, a Gallup poll found that 45% of the workforce said the global pandemic had a negative impact on their work engagement, productivity, and stress levels. Those who were already self-described workaholics found their condition exacerbated. Well into 2022, studies showed that working from home blurred boundaries and led to a surge of people burning the midnight oil and burning themselves out. The new work trend led to 40% of American workers identifying themselves as modern-day workaholics, indicating an urgent need to address mental health and well-being in the workplace. A Vizier report found that the pandemic created widespread remote work, with burnout at epidemic proportions. 89%. These trends were an indication of how work continued to slither its way into every hour of our day, the smartphoning of our lives. But how smart are we, really? Shortly after the publication of the first edition of Chained to the Desk, we entered a new century. A lot happened in terms of work and workaholism by the time the second edition was released in 2007. In the 1990s, BlackBerries were something you consumed, not something that consumed you. If you had a Bluetooth, you went to the dentist instead of to work. By 2007, the 1990s workday phrase 9-to-5 had become a dinosaur, replaced by the 24/7 of the new millennium. During the years between each of the three editions of Chained to the Desk, we worked longer and longer hours. According to U.S. News and World Report, the work week jumped from 44 hours in 1998 to 47 in 2000. And the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development reported that Americans put in 20% more hours in 2012 than in 1970, with 60-hour work weeks becoming the norm. Along with that time increase, work stress skyrocketed. Studies show that after financial worries, job pressures are the second major cause of stress among Americans. According to the American Psychological Association, 62% of Americans said their jobs caused them stress in 2007. But the figure had jumped to 70% in 2011 and 71% in 2021 in the association's follow-up studies. But not only has the problem of workaholism not gone away, it has worsened, hence chained to the desk in a hybrid world. How this book will be helpful. This book provides an inside look at work stress and addiction, debunking myths, refuting false claims, and setting the record straight with the available clinical research, empirical data, and case studies. Since the first three editions of Chained to the Desk appeared, new studies have emerged that provide deeper insights into work stress and the effects work addiction has on the workaholic's family. From California to the Carolinas, men and women recount their agonizing bouts with work addiction and the devastation left in its wake. It's no accident that personal stories in San Diego resemble the accounts of those in Atlanta. It's no coincidence that patient after patient in Charlotte who grew up with workaholics describe haunting feelings that are strikingly similar to those of children of workaholics in Peoria, St. Louis, and Houston. It's not a fluke that spouses and partners of workaholics in New York describe experiences that are identical in almost every detail to those of partners in other parts of the country and around the world. These personal accounts are not scientific in the quantitative sense, but they carry their own validity. They document the psychological experiences of individuals affected by work stress and addiction, and the details in so many accounts provide such an uncanny match that the emerging profiles cannot be attributed to chance alone. In this respect, we have a qualitative science of work addiction derived from the parallel themes and feelings that clinicians have observed in the field. This is the only book that reveals the devastating effects of work stress and overworking on the workforce as a whole, and on those who live and toil with workaholics, their partners, offspring, and business associates. It contains new and innovative research on the outcomes of adults who carry the legacies of their workaholic parents and the problems this creates in their own adult relationships. As before, each chapter opens with a case study, followed by information assembled from hundreds of case reports and a small body of clinical and empirical research. In addition to the published research of others, I have drawn on my own personal experiences, the research I've conducted at the University of North Carolina at Charlotte, my vast clinical experience with workaholics and their families, my work as a contributor to Forbes.com and ThriveGlobal.com, my position as Chief Architect Officer at Comfort Zones Digital, and correspondence from around the world. I bring the information to you in a listenable way for workaholics, their families, and clinicians who might be struggling with these issues. I have written for psychologists, social workers, marriage and family therapists, counselors, health educators, the clergy, medical practitioners, teachers, healthcare administrators, heads of corporations, and employee assistance personnel, as well as those struggling with workaholism themselves. Chained to the Desk in a Hybrid World reveals the origin and scope of work addiction, its pervasiveness within the family system, and how professionals can diagnose, intervene, and provide treatment for workaholics and their families. A makeover for the hybrid world. If you're familiar with the earlier Chained to Desk books, you will notice some significant differences in this one. For starters, it has a new organization. Part 1, Work Addiction, The New American Idol, describes the problem of workaholism with updates and revisions. Part 2, When Work Addiction Hits Home, explores how work addiction, like all addictions, is a family disease, affecting the entire family. Part 3, Risky Business, Invasion of the Balance Snatchers, includes three new chapters that profile societal and corporate trends enabling work addiction. And Part 4, Recovery from Work Addiction, focuses on solutions. I include new information on work stress and job burnout, radical self-care and self-compassion, life balance, how to integrate mindfulness by meditating on the fly throughout the workday with micro-chillers. Short, quick, and effective stress management exercises of 5 minutes or less throughout the workday. In addition, I incorporate a tool on how to heal workaholic tendencies called the AAA practice, an offshoot from Dr. Richard Schwartz's internal family systems therapy.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?